Can it be noted that there are no apologies for other members, namely the EFF?
No second. Thank you. President?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we start, good morning, honorable members, members of the media, colleagues from CMR, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. The department will be presenting the strategy of Namina, and we consider this strategy very important in growing the economy as well as for job creation. And my colleague, Ms. Mihale, will be taking us through the presentation. Over to you, Ms. Mihale.
Good morning, honorable chairperson, honorable members, colleagues. Sitipani Mahale is my name, as I was introduced by Mr. Bundy. And we were asked to come and give her a presentation in terms of our program and a full set in addressing the junior miners' opportunities and challenges. So this is definitely a work in progress, and we have been given a tight deadline of the end of June. And I'll just give you an indication of what we are expected to deliver as a department by the end of June. In this presentation, we'll just give you a little bit of background. We thought it was important that we begin by all of us being on the same page in terms of what we're talking about, so that we don't all of us leave with a different understanding of the problem and on the targeted beneficiaries. So the background, it's not going to be a long story about in 1982 or 1905, but it's just going to be making sure that we're all leaving from the same theoretical and definition point. Those target beneficiaries then will be outlined clearly for members, also with a focus area for not just today's presentation, but for 2017. We will link what we are going to do clearly to the outcomes that we want to achieve, and then commit to the outputs that we are going to deliver in order to reach those outcomes. We'll take you through the process to date, the way we've been working, and then we'll start to show you what the strategy is going to look like and what we see as the critical success factors or the strategic pillars for us to address. We, of course, recognize that there are different critical success factors for junior miners, but we have taken the view that we will just pick one up and discuss it more in more detail with members today. They are not all of them fully developed, but we wanted to just touch on the funding issue. We will just take you through a couple of examples of projects as we are receiving them and developing them, and then just take us to the way forward and the conclusion. When we say junior miners, maybe we can start there. Some people will define them, junior in their head will mean small as in young, as in between 18 and 35. No, let me do the presentation, but will mean young or youth. Or you can take the Australian model, where it talks about the size of the firm, either by capex, by revenue, number of employees, or they define them strictly in terms of exploration activity. So what we have done here is just to show you the intersection between the two honorable members. In the Australian approach, they use junior to almost mean mid-tier. I don't know if it's possible to reduce some of the lights. Sorry, honorable chair. Are you able to see? Okay. They use junior to mean mid-tier. So you're not quite artisanal and small scale, but you're not yet possibly at the level of established majors or a multinational. In the one that most people would know is this one of placing juniors in their context as exploration champions. So when you do this, look at the exploration triangle, so they call it. I'm sure members would have seen this before. And then we indicate that at the pre-competitive level, which is the very, very bottom of that pyramid, that's normally where established geo-surveys like the Canadian and Australian ones go. Then you have what you call grassroots exploration, where they take sophisticated, integrated geological survey information and take it to the next level in terms of prospecting and development. And then you've got your major mining houses who normally deal, as you see there towards the top, with brownfield exploration, with seeing on the ore body if we can explore or expand, but on existing finds. So they are defined in terms of those activities in exploration. We place there this project life cycle so that we are quite clear in that regard, that even in the Australian model, you can be a junior miner, and it's just the size of your company all throughout prospecting, exploration, development, extraction, and closure. A junior miner is not defined by just the prospecting and extraction or exploration activities. So in our view, honorable members, we have said that we have got a particular challenge of exploration and prospecting expenditure in South Africa. We have got a particular challenge of the involvement, meaningful involvement, ownership of mining assets, development and management of mining assets by the historically disadvantaged of black people. And we have got high barriers to entry for generally new entrants and youth and women. So we did not want to confine ourselves to either the Australian or the Canadian model. What we have done is to indicate that what we want to identify opportunities for new entrants. We want to increase the amount of economic activity that's happening on the ground. And so we have identified 7 entry points, if you will, honorable members, for new entrants. And this was done by looking throughout the project life. So the first one is the one that you're most familiar with, as the one that we have had a program on, the small-scale artisanal mining. Prospectors and developers, mining operators, mid-tier and large, and then also active BEE equity participation. We saw a need there to say while we are developing a strategy that will help new entrants and junior miners, there are clearly overflows that will benefit BEEs, which are currently operating. There are services that they can also that can also benefit them in terms of growing and becoming their own mine owners and operators, and not just an equity partner of an existing investment. We looked at the opportunities for mining suppliers and service providers. We looked at the opportunities for beneficiators. These last two honorable members will see are looking upstream and downstream of the actual mining that's happening. And we thought that while we are developing the strategy for junior miners, we must not forget that they must have a market for beneficiation, and they must also have steady and regular supply in terms of suppliers and service providers. We also then looked at our own particular challenges as South Africa with regards to our environmental legacy of mining, and identified that there's a clear opportunity with regards to environmental rehabilitation and remining and processing of historic dumps and remining of mines that were abandoned or left derelict and ownerless. So what we have identified there is that there are 5 strategic outcomes that we would want to contribute to. The first one is to increase investment and job creation in the mining sector. We want to support vibrant small and medium scale enterprises in the mining value chain. We want to support rural development and improve spatial distribution of wealth and income and economic activity. We want to support the diversification of economic activities through mining. Those are the multipliers. And we also want to see an increased entrance and participation of youth and women and their economic empowerment through the strategy. And we intend to do this through delivering to you three key outputs. The first one is a strategy that identifies and addresses bottlenecks throughout the mining life cycle. This is also going to then be used to develop what we are calling a mining toolkit for new entrants. We are hearing a lot, honorable members, about people who spent 10 years, 5 to 10 years burning their fingers and learning over and over again lessons that should have been properly documented and give them at least a head start in terms of the basics that should be known, the basic skills, the basic needs in terms of compliance. This shouldn't have to be borne by each and every individual who wants to enter the space. As a government, we have that responsibility to provide that toolkit to entrepreneurs for the mining space. And then we'd also want to engage in direct project support, financial and non-financial. So to date, we have engaged in desktop studies, also learning from previous study tours that were undertaken by other members of government. We didn't engage in a study tour ourselves specifically dedicated to this, but study tours have been undertaken to Australia and to Canada and to other mining jurisdictions where these issues were addressed. And we had started by saying, let's look at all of those reports and see what we can get from them before we then say we want to embark on a separate study tour specifically for this. We have engaged in project packaging. Honorable members will recall that before we went to the mining endeavor, we indicated that we want to take new entrants and their projects and package them properly for investment promotion. I mean, this might sound a bit shallow, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, but when you talk to investors, they'll tell you something as simple as, I'm not going to invest in the project of somebody, A, who doesn't have a website. B, if it's a gold exploration project and I see any gold bars on the website, I turn off. So they are little things in terms of how you package and talk to investors that we were able to do at the Indaba. We were also able to, through the Indaba organizers, introduce them to what we called an investment battlefield, where they went and pitched to experienced investors and fund managers. And then they were given feedback in terms of what they need to do going forward when they are pitching their projects. So that we have been doing, we did at the Mining Endeavor. We took their projects again to the Prospectors and Developers Association of Canada conference in March. And we have learned a lot from those processes and with the members. We have also engaged in extensive consultation with BEE entrepreneurs, with junior miners, both mid-tier and for those which are specifically prospectors and generally new entrants, or the relatively new entrants. The most recent of these, honorable members will note, were held on the 15th of March, the 4th of April, and another one on the 20th of April. The approach here is to develop something that is not going to possibly be in the most elaborate or poetic language. It's not going to be 100 pages of prose. It needs to be speaking directly to what they are experiencing on the ground, and it needs to be responsive to those challenges. In the spirit of nothing for us without us, that is how we are working when we're developing the strategy. So please note, it's not bureaucrats behind closed doors. We have also engaged in consultations with development finance institutions, including the IDC and the TIC. And we are continuing in those consultations. There's a meeting shortly with the JSE, who launched the Empowerment Fund for Emerging Miners. And we, of course, as we're doing this, drafting the strategy and developing the toolkit. But we're also expected in this time between now and the end of June to not come out just with those, the strategy and the toolkit, but to have come out having identified specific projects that are already in development for us to further support in project preparation and access to finance. So when we are doing our the strategy that we're working on, it identifies these as challenges, and then there are also opportunities in the classic style that we call them, and we have talked to them as strategic pillars or critical success factors. The approach we have taken is to unpack each and every one of these individually, and then to match them to a specific part of the project life cycle. So you can't have a chapter on skills. You have to have a chapter that talks to skills in general, and then applies the skills requirements and availability of resources for skills development for prospecting and exploration. The skills you require for prospecting and exploration are quite different from those that you'll require for project development, for extraction, and for closure, reclamation, and environmental rehabilitation. And it doesn't have to be for each person to search in the dark. It must be that clear. General chapter on the skills, and then applied to each step of the project life cycle, and applied to each of those 7 opportunities. So for small scale miners, for suppliers, this is what you will need to know. We do the same with access to finance, which is the one that we'll take into more detail, Honorable Chair. The availability of geological information is a critical success factor, and it's obviously the most important at the level of prospecting and exploration. And then the compliance issues. For each and every stage, what you need to know, what you are expected to achieve, and also when we're doing this, we're also looking for any synergies that can be enhanced and contradictions that can be addressed in the compliance issue. We looked at R&D and technology and access to markets as well, and this is linked again to the beneficiation example. But here, honorable members, when we're looking at this, your access to market issues for prospectors and developers and people who choose to remain in this space, your Canadian-style juniors, their access to market issues are quite different, as you would know, to those who are engaging in extraction and to those who are engaging in beneficiation. So that is the detail of the structure and the approach that we are taking to the strategy itself. I had indicated that we will take the access to funding one in for members, just to give you an example and to give you a flavor of the work that we're doing in these pillars. So we took, for the purposes of today's presentation, the prospectors and developers as an example. And we looked here to say, what is actually the mischief that is occurring when it comes to exploration investment? Obviously, one of the buzzwords or the buzz discussions that have been happening is that there's very little money in the past 3 to 5 years that's going to juniors. They had a boom period, mid-2000s to late-2000s, and then suddenly it seems like the money has dried up. And there are more and more people, junior miners, explorers, and prospectors, who are chasing fewer and fewer dollars. And as a logical person, when you're thinking about mining, because we always say the same thing when it comes to issues of regulatory certainty, we say mining is a long-term business and it's cyclical. So I can't put in money today and expect to make a return tomorrow. By the time I have to invest for a long period, there's a long investment lag before returns start coming. And the cyclical nature of it is the 7 lean years, 7 fat years, 7 lean years. But somehow, the investment community still invests in exploration based on the current prices of minerals. And this is shown here in this graph that was done by Doggett in 2015, just using copper as an example. The red line is the price of copper, and then the blue graphs underneath it are the exploration expenditures in terms of copper. You will see that exploration expenditure not only generally correlates with the price, but it lags behind the price. So not only do we not work in a way that says the copper price is going to rise within the next 10 years, and by that time I want to be ready to bring my mine online. We are, as a mining community, waiting for the copper price to be high for a short period before we start then ramping up. So we there are lost opportunities throughout. And this makes it very difficult for those in the prospecting and developing stages. We also, when engaged with the DFIs and the banks, they basically shared with us this view. And I mean, on the screen it looks very brown, they're very bottom, but it's green. And they indicated to us, well, in a robot system approach, exploration we see as high risk, and then there you must fund it from your pocket, or you see where you get the money, because that is red zone for us. This is a general trend, even with commercial banks. Then they say it starts to get a little bit better around when you've got a scoping study. And there they are what they call retail speculators, and then you can get, again, private equity, or you can get a major mining house that will invest in that exploration project, hoping to take it over. Then it gets lower and lower risk, and more players come in as you go to feasibility study, the construction, and of course, once you're at production, everybody's happy to give you corporate finance, project finance, working capital, and shareholders are also investing more readily. The same is shown, if you don't mind, on the next slide in a graphical form. So we show, honorable members, the project life cycle that we had shown you before. But we're showing it now in graph form. With at the very top, we're dividing this quadrant this is your x-axis is increasing certainty. So as you move from the corner, that's high uncertainty, and as you go out towards the right, that's increasing certainty. But at the top of that page, you must read this, please, honorable members, with the correlating stage in the project life cycle. So exploration is the one that they see as high risk, that was the red in the previous slide. Evaluation is where it starts to get a little bit yellowy, murkier. And then development and production is when it's green, 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 all systems go. The blue line, their members, refers to the value of the project. So obviously when you're prospecting and you're not mining anything, your value is close to zero. It's theoretical. It is hoped for. It is potential. And as you move up to evaluation and then development, you become clearer and clearer about the amount of ore you have, the cost of extracting it, and the possible profitability. The red one is the risk factor. So you can see that as your value increases and your risk also correspondingly decreases. As you develop the project, it goes higher in value, lower in risk. So what we've identified there is just using, I'm going to use IDC as an example, that's the one that's on your slide. IDC says, right, we agree for development and production, once all of your ducks are in a row and you are now looking to just put in a washing plant, or you just want working capital, we've got you. Debt funding, straight up. If you're at exploration phase, they say that they can even join you at pre-feasibility, depending on the strength of the project and the geological information that you have from desktop studies and from previous extraction. They said, no, there we can enter as an equity shareholder. Before that, it seems very few people play. And that's where we are saying, is this a funding gap? Or is it more of a trust gap? And it's a little bit of both. We take you to the next slide where we have obviously looked at, as we've looked in the previous slide, at providers of equity, all of the different options you have at each stage, equity, private equity, development finance institutions, commercial banks. And then we have said that if we take it that there's also the BCC model, we've also gone into some discussion on, and we still need to consult further on that because the industry indicates that there are some challenges in terms of the accessibility and the suitability of that tool. But we say to ourselves, this funding gap here, how do we close it? Because we don't have an endless pool of money as a country. So it's not like we can just demand of the IDC to just take on that risk at the expense of their balance sheet. And their other projects, the industrial development projects, the PIC is holding people's pension money. So it's not out of evil that they're saying that they don't enter this risky space. It is because their own prudential management will not allow them to do it in this current environment. So we borrowed from Western Mining Australia Services, I'll remember the exact name, this exploration aggregator model, which is one of the ones that we are looking at, to say, before we say we're going to find billions and billions of dollars, we're going to change the rules of VCC, how do we get the current pool of money, availability of funding, and quality projects, how do we better match them to each other and bridge the trust divide between them so that they can actually move on with business as usual. So the model of this one called an exploration aggregator model. That sophisticated risk capital, that can be basically any capital or investment provider, from your IDC, your venture capital firms, etc. And they have got a huge trust deficit, as we indicated, with Greenfields and their projects. They need to meet with the geologist and sense that this person licks rocks for fun. They need to see your website and sense that there's a level of sophistication in there. So it tends to be less about the geological report that you bring and more about the trust that they have in you as an entrepreneur. And that's where the system is breaking down a little bit. So this model says that what you need is a exploration aggregator. So all of the projects that are being developed, prospecting rights that are being developed, you have a look at them, and then you work in the model, you work to develop them. In the Western Australian model, what they do is more of a screening. This process here, strategic portfolio approach, technical discipline, is about screening. It's about weeding out the losers and picking out the winners. And obviously, there will be an element of that at all points, and even in our own approach. But ours has to be more developmental. Because if we just focus on weeding out the losers, then we are undermining the imperative of encouraging new entrants and diversification. So in the normal model, it's a weeding out, and then the exploration aggregator has, after having looked at the projects and weeded out all of the weak projects, all of the ones with poor management teams, then takes them back to the sophisticated risk capital and says, here's A, B, and C. None of them are weak. None of them have gold bars on their website. All of them love geology and are highly experienced. And then you bridge that trust gap with the sophisticated risk capital. In our model, instead of an agent, we are considering, and we are already working in this regard, just to develop this model while we're working, to say it must be a multidisciplinary team. So in the Australian model, they say that it can be any agent, it can be a specialist, or it can actually be a major mining house, or an agent of the same funding houses, which then puts aside this, which then develops the exploration aggregator. In our case, our team is multidisciplinary, and it includes ourselves, the DMR, the IDC, PIC, the Council for Geoscience, and the private sector. We then, as I indicated, are still dealing with bridging this trust divide, but we are not doing it by just weeding out those who are weak. For right now, if they're not yet ready, it's not to hold up those projects which are ready, but they must still be put aside for further development while we facilitate the access to finance for those which are much more ready.
So we do project preparation support. And the second bullet is so fundamental, honorable members, geological information support. A lot of the time, we overdrill as juniors in the prospecting and exploration space because of our lack of access to geological information. A lot of these things may have been explored or prospected by a previous company, and the information which you are then looking for could be more readily available rather than sinking a further 10, 20 million in the ground. So the CGS is going to play a critical role in this regard. In fact, the IGC had indicated at one point to say, you know, somebody will come to me with the drill results of three holes that they've drilled, and then say, look there, there's platinum there. And they cannot actually invest until they have certainty of an ore body. So then the junior miner feels the need to go and prove that there's an ore body there on his own, when through the DMR's own records, and those of the CGS, we can support them through previous studies and through their own information, the CGS, to package it properly for the IDC and prove the presence of an ore body. We're also looking at a voucher system for drilling. I indicated that we were asked to start collecting and inviting projects for support. And what we found, honorable members, was a lot of people looking for capital equipment for drilling. Again, we're not a cash-rich country. We don't have that kind of capital to give Ubab Zondi money for drilling himself. He must buy his own drill rig. You must buy your own drill rig. Everybody must buy their own drill rig. And then we put pressure on the IDC or somebody else to keep financing these things. And to put the cost of the debt repayment on that asset on each of these people's books is also quite irresponsible. So we are looking at a voucher system for drilling work, laboratory work, and which would mean that rather than taking the full cost, so first of all, instead of having to drill everything, CGS and DMR must tell you on that site what do they have to see if there's any need to do any further work. And that's going to be, that team there will assist with that. Then, if there is a requirement for further work, then it is when you'll access through the voucher system, which will work with the CGS. They've got their own drill rig, but we want to see if they should be investing a little bit more in that. But we it has to be evidence-based. We can't thumb suck and say, no, CGS, I need you to go from 1 to 9. I want 1 per province because that's what sounds good in my head. It has to be based on the projects that we have on the ground and the demand that we see from these projects. Packaging for investment and facilitation of access to finance, as indicated, that we'll be doing those as well. I'll just 2 slides away, honorable members, before the conclusion, and going straight to those examples. I'm calling them Project A and Project B for now, but we are just starting to get a feeling of where are people stuck, what kind of projects do they have, so that all what we do is definitely evidence-based and is responsive. So we've got a project here, for example, in KwaZulu-Natal. We do ask for the black ownership or the BBBEE and other information because we don't want to keep going back to companies asking them over and over again. Some funds require that or will prioritize those sorts of things, especially in terms of the transformation imperative. So they must tell us up front, and we ask them to give it to us in blocks of under 50, between 50 and 75, 75 and to 100. So this one is in the 75 to 100. I happen to know this is 100% black owned. And they are doing exploration for coal in KZN. And on the site, they say that there is some potential for coking coal to be found as well. And they are at that pre-competitive gap space. They are requesting 70 million rand to complete drilling work and also to develop their mine. And they believe that at fully operational, the mine will support 450 jobs. So this is what we are doing now with the team, even in Pretoria. All the submissions are being vetted. We are asking them if they say 70 million for the invoices, exactly how that 70 million raised, how is it comprised. We find some of these are inflated, some of these are under estimates. A lot of them have not yet started to consider other costs beyond drilling, the laboratory work, the environmental guarantees, and etc. Project B is another example, again an exploration phase, this time in the Free State, in the 50 to 75 band, and it's a heavy minerals project, and they are looking to mine ilmenite, zircon, rutile, and monazite. They think that there's a, they're not looking for 380 rand, they are looking for 380 million rand. This is a perfect example of one that we don't believe has been well costed. 380 million rand. The value of this entire project, when they broke it down, was about 1.1 billion rand. And they're saying 380 just for exploration and prospecting. Now, if we assist them with existing geological information, the voucher system, we are hoping this 380 can come all the way down I don't want to say the number now, but it shouldn't be a 380. It should not be a 380. Because they shouldn't do the drilling like there's nothing that's ever happened on that ground prior to them. And here, we believe that there could be a small underestimate in terms of the jobs. We have to look at these things, honorable members, in terms of how we prioritize our limited funding. Even issues of jobs that are gotten per million rand invested. The other project you saw, Project A, was talking about 70 million for 450 jobs. This one is essentially talking about 1 billion for 100 jobs. So this is the work that has to be done. We had to ask them to submit, but we have to now go back and verify. Who have you previously requested funding from? You were rejected. On what basis were you rejected? Send us a rejection letter so that we also don't start from scratch when we're doing the investment facilitation. The last slide of November is just to let you know what we'll be doing as we go forward. We didn't focus on the small-scale and artisanal miners, but we certainly are still working on that one. We didn't focus on the small-scale and artisanal miners, but we're definitely looking at relaunching and revamping the financial and non-financial support to this sector. The same lessons learned are the ones we're talking about in the voucher system for the prospectors and developers is the same lesson learned that we have for small-scale miners. There is not really any need for me to buy the same crusher for all of us mining in one vicinity, and then we all sit with this debt on our balance sheet. So the lease option in the voucher system is the way forward in this regard, and encouraging more cooperatives. It's a very small amount of money we have, and it must be made to stretch. For the prospectors and developers specifically, we're looking at strengthening the exploration aggregator model, and we're really working on piloting that model, so that by the time we come here at the end of June, we've got a few pilots, just like the project A and B, to say, hey, we tried this thing, and this is what we have learned, and this is what we'll be doing going forward. We want to finalize the strategy. I know that this is the least attractive of all of them, because there's a sense that we are doing too many strategies and documents, but this will be finalized by June. And also to strengthen the institutional mechanisms for implementation. We are looking to we're looking to publish the new entrance toolkit for mining around the same time, and to make sure that this is widely communicated. In now taking government to the people, we're looking to address opportunities for all seven of those that were identified. We don't actually have the money to do a roadshow for prospectors and developers, then come back to KZN in a different bus, this time for procurement and mining suppliers, come back in a different bus, this time for prospectors and developers. So we have to make sure that when we are out there, even if we do it in three different meetings targeted, that taking government to the people addresses all seven of those opportunities for people as they go out. We were looking at doing career awareness, youth days, and small business association outreach. Consultations will continue with stakeholders and other government departments, rural development, COPTA, small business development, EDD, the DTI. And then we will just make sure that as we go on, we identify and actively plan for synergies and not contradictions with this program and other priority programs of government. Here we have just listed, for example, the issues of rehabilitation in terms of reclamation and closure, opportunities to identify, illegal mining, again for the re-mining and legitimization of our resources and mining, and the Black Industrials Program specifically for the procurement and service providers element. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, we give power to them. So sometimes you must continue until you are told to stop. Thank you very much. Let me explain my apologies. Today I thought I could get traffic. Thank you for accepting my apology in advance. Are there any questions or clarifications? I could say that Honorable Masala was so excited that he could arrive first in a It's magical. That things do happen. Okay, any questions? Thank you very much for the presentation. Honorable Lorena, Honorable Schmidt, Hoshi Matala. I hear you when I say Hoshi Matala. Nkosu Mande.
Yeah.
Oh, Nkosu Lorim.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. It's a very interesting report, and I think in its own terms, it's a good report. However, it's those terms that I want to question, and this is very much an emphasis on state help in the sense of making things available for prospective miners. And I do realize you did say you were concentrating on one aspect, but what I hear from junior miners is it's not so much, well, partly it's a lack of resources, but it's also a number of obstacles created by the state which are in the way. And I'm talking about red tape, and that can be in various forms. So I'd just like to know whether you did have a look at that. Also, would you be able to comment on the comparison of state involvement in promoting junior miners in countries like Australia and Canada? I am made somewhat uneasy by the government deciding which companies are going to work and not. Historically, governments have a poor record of picking winners in business. The primary example, I suppose, is Soviet Union. So perhaps you'd like to comment on that too. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's indeed a very interesting presentation, and I think it encapsulates most of the issues, the broader issues, especially the rest of the but can I just ask, on your page 6, your slide 6, do you, I remember at some stage a few years ago, MQA was involved. They got courses called the Executive Management Course for people who might be interested in mining. I'm not sure whether that could be shaped or reshaped into certain sections, let's say for artisanal mining or for exploration activities or for mining activities, whatever is applicable. So maybe that's one way of harnessing some of the existing learning models. Then, you know, I read your graph on page slide 9 with interest, because ideally one should be anti-cyclical in investment, because when the price is low, it will pick up and you can start investing. When the take-up is there, that you're on the right side of the ticket. It's too late when you, like for instance, yours like 2030, start investing, because 2 years down the line, it hits the low mark and you've missed out an opportunity. So, and that's why it goes hand in hand with what government or Department of Treasury or whatever foresees in future, I would guess, with you know, what the cyclical trends are of not only minerals, but also the world economy. So those two will determine when and where you should get involved in, because, and it's not a one-size-fits-all rule. One commodity might differ dramatically from another commodity because of whatever, because of too much supply on the market, or what do you call it, when you've got a substantive, you have an alternative product on the market, you have a particular word for it. You don't need platinum, you rely on palladium because of the price, whatever, the substitutive. So all these issues have an impact as to where and when you should invest. Then, you seem to me to take on the role of a project management role. If all this needs a project, and you have, let's say, you take on 5 companies or 5 possible businesses, it can be 5 different projects or 7 different projects. I mean, so it will require a lot of input from different departments to steer it. But one thing that's always stuck in my mind is Canadians make use of the flow-through process, where, if I understand correctly, big mining companies invest in small exploration companies and then obtain what they call flow-through shares, where by the time it's listed, you are then benefit from tax and other benefits, which makes it it ensures, by lack of a better word, it facilitates investment in exploration activities because of tax, because of other. So one could consider flow through shares in trying to stimulate in a broader way and for a particular market investment in high risk exploration activities as a spin off. But I don't know whether you put that. Then, just an interest. I see you do make a distinction between artisanal mining and small-scale miners. I talked today to understand what is meant, what the department looks at, what's the department's definition of artisanal mining. Is it small-scale in terms of, as you just quite correctly said, in terms of value, in terms of capex, in terms of revenue, in terms of people employed, whatever. But is artisanal mining legal mining? Is it regarded as legal mining? Is it an entity that has a legal right to mine? And is not up to the standard, whatever they call small scale mining? Or is artisanal mining, in inverted commas, illegal mining? Like, let's say, mining of base metals in your backyard, if you have a plot, which can be rectified. There's no intrinsic risk, such as deep level gold mining, illegal mining. You know, maybe if I understand the definition better of what the department regards artisanal mining as, I may understand this picture better.
Question,
my
friend.
Yeah.
Yes, Baba. Thank you, Chair. Mine's only 2 questions, they are not many. You made mention of you are going to take government to the people, especially in rural areas.
if I share with you when are you going to expand to other provinces, because when I check your presentation here, you always speak of KwaZulu-Natal, and I'm not sure as to whether when are you going to take this program to other provinces. If you have money to do so, maybe you'll have to request some other allocations from the department to assist you to implement your program, because if it fails, it means you are not going anywhere, because number one chair, where I come from, I met recently the leaders, the traditional leaders, House of Traditional Leaders. and the way this, as you know, chiefs are very sensitive when coming to the issue of mining, and with the issue of pen beneficiations. This they are intending to establish a youth structure. A youth structure within the House of Traditional Leaders. The issue here is that they also want that youth structure amongst themselves to benefit from the programs of the DMR. Are you considering also to meet with some of the structures that will be established by the House of Traditional Leaders? Secondly, regarding the community involvement, would you consider meeting the community? Because when you meet with young structures, or particularly youth in a particular area, if you consider meeting the community, because some of the things involved, they need the participation of the community, except to say, I mentioned the traditional leaders. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Cosmana.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, honorable members, the delegation from the GMR. Honorable Chair, I am back from my paternity leave.
And
I can tell you all.
You can see that thing.
I would be very keen to uptake the extension, Chair. But powers be require me to be there. The Honorable Chair, I think not having consulted Sarah, but Honorable Matlala is tapping into something that I was going to dwell on, but we never had an engagement on the matter. It should be specific that he's not referring to me as a traditional leader, but the Provincial House of Traditional Leaders in his constituency in Limpopo, where he comes from. And it may be taken likely to, or be mistaken to be the National House of Traditional Leaders, or perhaps to give guidance and care, it's the Provincial House of Traditional Leaders. But I'm more interested, Chair, on slide number 6, the outcomes and outputs that have been identified there. Living in a rural constituency, in a rural province, that being the Eastern Cape, there's bullet number 3 there, talks to rural development and improved spatial distribution of wealth. How is this to be achieved? And when will it be achieved? What are the targets in that regard? I always have an issue, Chair, with the outcomes that are thrown loosely, and no targets are set there. Is it a 2020 vision? Is it a 2030 vision? Is it a 2063 vision? I'm not sure when we are supposed to be attaining these outcomes and outputs.
I'd like to gain clarity in that. But also, like Honorable Matala has said, rural development speaks of land that is mostly vested around traditional councils as led by traditional leaders. I'd like to understand the thinking, Honorable Chair, in terms of the department as to how they seek to ensure spatial distribution of wealth in terms of those tribal authorities or traditional councils, ensuring that it is a true empowerment and upliftment of the local communities as led by traditional leaders. But the increased investment and job creation, exactly how much investment is going to be contributed to increase that, and as a result, how much job creation is going to be achieved? Is it within this fiscal 2017-2018? And if it is, then how many jobs will be created during this fiscal? I'd like us to be able to pinpoint things, Honorable Chair, rather than just throwing things loosely out there. We speak about youth and women, economic empowerment. Exactly how many youth are going to be empowered in this? And how many women are going to be empowered in this? What are the targets? Are we focusing on this fiscal, or are we throwing it into a vision of 2020 or 2030 or 2063, Honorable Chair? But we're somewhat in that identifying of these empowered groups have seemed to eliminate people with disabilities. Nothing is made mention of in regards to them. I'd like to understand why is that, Honorable Chair. If we come to slide number 12, Honorable Chair, strategic portfolio approach, technical disciplines, I don't know what is that, SSS, in there. I'd like to be enlightened because in South Africa, I don't seem to know a currency that is written in those terms. But being proudly South African, I talk of rands and always want to understand things in rand. Now, there is a foreign expression there which I'd be very keen to be enlightened on in terms of this department and its understanding of currencies is seemingly shying away from our rand value, which we strongly believe in and is committed. That is all for now, Honorable Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. And Ms. Mohale will give us, provide us answers to the questions we didn't have.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and Mr. Zondi. Honorable members, thank you so much for your input. I think, as we had said at the beginning of the presentation, that this is a work in progress. And so we thought to be guided by you and your expectations, and I think a lot of them, through yourself, Chairperson, have been value-adding, and we'll definitely take them with us as we move forward. If I may start with Honorable Marima. You're quite right, sir, that we are saying that we want to see how we get the system to do more, but we also have to see what we can improve internally as well if there are blockages that are created by ourselves. And so we haven't shied away from that. There is an entire block there called compliance,
and it deals with those issues. And it deals with them at each step of the value chain. So the compliance requirements, a lot of these we've developed because we had fairly loosely regulated mining for over a century, which had some unintended consequences in terms of the mine and health and safety of workers, in terms of local economic development, and in terms of the environment. So a lot of these are developed to make sure that as we pursue short to medium term gains, we don't do it at the expense of progeny. But that is definitely the intention here, is not to be ideological or to be defensive about it, but to say at each step what is required and what does the sector what is the sector view on this? Are there any contradictions? One of the ones that you and I'll use the example of small scale miners just as an example, even though we're focusing on juniors and exploration here. For small scale miners, previously you could go and at any point you find somebody mining sand, you could say, "Hi, Mama Hani the guy." No, then she says, "No, that I'm fine. Do you have a permit for that?" "No, I didn't know I need a permit." "No, here's the application form. Give me your ID number." And then we fill in the application form for you. I take it back to the regional office, and then we get you in the system to become legal. And it's just an unintended consequence of the development, is that you know now, honourable members, that it has to be done online through the standard application system. So those are some of the things that when you say taking government to the people, it's going to have to be, the reason we wanted that was for that there's increased transparency, that anybody can access it even in Canada, but it might make it more difficult because some people in the rural areas, we would well know, access their internet through the phone. And if you've ever tried to do an application on your phone, it's very difficult. You need an iPad or desktop moving up. So those are some of the issues that are coming up, and I don't think that we would want to just dream them up or to just be defensive or ideological about it. Let the evidence and the examination at each step show what the requirements are, and then we can have a look to say that one, how do we help people because it's acting as a barrier. So if it's something as simple as we need to take government to the people, we've got a van with computers in there so that people can actually start to actively lodge the application while you're there. Those are the things that we need to start thinking about for each and every one of them. But I think that is definitely the case. We don't want to put in efforts and invest when it could have just been about reorganizing the way we do work before we put in more money and effort. I think that point is well taken, Chairperson and Honorable Lorimer. I did indicate that this model, and maybe it can come back as well to Hoshi Gosi Mandela question. This is a model that was in our own work, it was suggested, and it's an Australian model. That's exactly how it stands in the Australian model. I've got no problems with the RAND. I've just taken it from the Australian model. And what we have taken the honourable members through is to say, when we are looking at how best to do this work, which we have a deadline for June, we are looking at what has worked elsewhere, how we would apply it to our own case. That's why we put the model as it is developed for Australia by Australians there. And as I say, there, their approach is to pick winners and to pick losers. That is not going to be our approach. That's not going to be our role. For us, all we can do is to say, sitting there with the IDC and the CGS, is to say, now this project, it went from saying it still needs to do further exploration. CGS can say, no, that information, I have it. That project is now ready to go to IDC. It's not for us to pick who the winner will be. Because, as I say, in the Australian model, they then say, stop crowding the market. Honorable Lorimer, your project needs more help. You've got those gold bars on your website. Please leave. we are going to eliminate you from this pool because people are losing trust for the project of Honorable Schmidt because you're bringing down the average. So that's how they do it in Australia, but that's not how it's going to work in South Africa. We can't do it like that here. We can say those which are ready, we just take them the last step in terms of whether it's something that the DMR, IDC, PIC can do for them, and then they get back into the market. Those who aren't ready, those who still need help, some are coming without the appropriate rights, some are coming without the appropriate skills. Some of them are needing a lot more development work. All we were saying is that we're not going to hold up the project of Honorable Schmidt until your project is perfect, Honorable Barrowman. If his project is closer to meeting the requirements of the funders, we do the last 5% with him, and then we take it back to market. But you, we're not going to tell you that, no, yours is a loser project, you must go and try other business, maybe for you. This is too big a game for you. We have to still work with that individual or that company and see and show them how much further they have to go and identify at each stage. And as you had pointed out, Honorable Schmidt, if it's an issue of skills, there are programs at the MQA. We just didn't go into each of those pillars into detail. We just thought for today we'll zoom into the funding one. But there are programs for each one. For each one of them, we identify for each one of them we identify existing programs, challenges, key risks, and etc. And so, one of the programs we have identified are those under MQA. And the chairperson of MQA is here, so I'm glad that me and you have found him together. The next issue, I think, was from yourself, Honorable Schmidt. Was that investment should be counter-cyclical. You know, this is not a South African graph, this one on copper. It's a global graph, and it's not a graph about last week or last Tuesday. It's a graph that stretches from 1979, if honorable members can see, to 2013. So there's something, you know, free marketeers will always say human beings are rational economic actors. Leave them to themselves and they will make sure that the market comes to equilibrium. As an economist, I can tell you that the statistical data doesn't seem to bear that out. When IT stock is hot, we don't go and say rationally, this thing is probably overheating. I should have joined earlier. It's too late now for me to join the bandwagon. No, we still run and buy IT stocks and then boom, goes the market. They say that, you know, the way it's like a staircase. When markets are growing, they grow in staircase, and they drop in a steep boom. So by the time you're watching people moving into the game, you get in just here at the highest price, and then you lose the most. So for some reason, this is not a South African phenomenon. It's not a copper phenomenon. It just keeps happening. And what we have realized is that the major mining houses and the CEOs, they're also under pressure. You know, the turnover of CEOs there is, I think you're a veteran after 18 months. You join the CEOs Veteran League. So you need to be very responsive to the shareholders and to short-term results, which your bonuses are dependent on. By the time you start planning for 7 years from now, that's 6 CEOs later. And you would not even, you were not given the chance to do that. So that's one of the elements. The other element we know is that the more and more we turn to speculative hedge fund type of investment, these are people who don't want to know whether you're mining or baking cookies. They want margins, they want margins now. So you can't go to them and say, no, well, the nature of the industry is such that you must not see anything from this investment for 7 years. Hedge funds want to move their money in and out, get that margin and move. So those are some of the issues that are causing this to happen. And what is definitely required is that the CGS needs to come in a big way to smoothen this. We need to encourage more people to come in and come in now which, as you've already pointed out, is almost too late, because the prices were much lower 2 years ago, and they're starting to pick up. People are starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel. So hopefully, through this model, we'll be able to smoothen that out and also increase it for South Africans. I think that the point is indeed of project management, it comes also to the point of Koshimatala, is that we are not yet running the program at full force. We are still learning from other people's experiences, from our own pilots, and we are still developing models and adapting models. But once the strategy is approved, the institutional mechanisms and the funding thereof will have to be addressed as well. So at the moment, we're working with a team that is almost that's been pulled off of their normal work, as this is a priority project. But as you said, if it's going to be a project management function, you need dedicated people who are not going to be 1 minute doing standard personnel work, next minute dealing with projects and doing proper project support. It needs to be split. It needs to be dedicated. And that's one of the recommendations. But we don't want to run ahead of ourselves and say we will need officers in Sandton and a staff of 10 people and a budget of 10 million. We want the work to show and to prove that for us. The floating shares model, I did indicate that we looked at this. We discussed it with industry. And we need to discuss it further with the National Treasury. Because we do have that model that in terms on the letter of the law, section 12J deals with venture capital and floating shares. What they're telling us is that the structure of it in South Africa is broad-based. They require you to be broad-based before you access that. So you can't grab up all of that as an individual. And they think that the Canadian model, I can do that. I can sit at my computer, choose, and as an individual, I can just invest and then get my tax a rebate on that. While in South Africa, they are indicating that you need to be a broad-based five or some members in a consortium and project, and they think that makes it harder to take up. When we last checked, I think it was one project that had actually taken up this facility. So it's not that we don't have it, it's that we just need to look at its applicability and suitability for what we need to do. But that needs to happen in the consultation. In the meantime, we were not given a leeway to say we'll still consult. We're told to look at other options. And so that exploration aggregator model is just another example of what others are doing, and that we're going to pilot, not after the strategy is done, but while we're developing the strategy. That kind of time we don't have on our hands. Honorable Schmidt, the last one I didn't answer was artisanal versus small scale. So let's say in Ghana, I heard that there was talk about Ghana. Don't ask me where I heard it, gentlemen. Just on the street pulse. We heard in a situation like Ghana, and you have it in South Africa as well. Artisanal I think we can send it through the chairperson the classification that we use in terms of small, micro, etc. But just conceptually, artisanal are normally those who are doing it seasonally. And we had a discussion with members when we were doing the illegal mining discussion, is that some of them will do it seasonally in the off-season from their agricultural jobs. Then they'll supplement just to smooth their income, their subsistence income for the year. That is still, if they don't have a permit for it, that is still, it's still a legal activity. But it's to be treated differently, because those are people who are normal.
Illegal activities or legal?
No, it's not. It's illegal, because the law requires you to have a permit before you mine. But if you know that there's a difference between the way you treat somebody who you find mining sand with their baby on their back, just to be not to be too pastoral about it, but you know, and somebody who's dealing with reopening a shaft. in Lang Lachter and mining that. So it's not illegal. And when we go to them, that's people who we are able to approach to say, Madma, you know you're supposed to have a permit. And then she says, I don't have 300 rand to go to Polokwane and back here, and I don't have a computer. Then you have to address that, because that person is not being is not doing it for commercial gain, but also not doing it maliciously.
Mm-hmm.
It's not malicious non-compliance. It's just that the cost, as the Honourable Lorimer had reminded us, of compliance has become a barrier to legal entry for that person. So that's what we call artisanal. And then the small scale miners are those who are taking it more as a full time, if not full time, but it's not a subsistence issue. For them, it's now a business issue, and they are normally permitted through the department in terms of mining permits. Koshimatala, we are definitely what we're doing now at the moment as a department is that we do 9 small scale mining workshops every year. That is statutory, and it's normally at least 1 per province, where we call in community members, we engage with traditional leaders, we engage with entrepreneurs, and say, Batomdimu, please note that if you want to mine legally, this is what you must go through, here are the people who will help you, etc., etc. Then we have Izimbiz. Then we have consultations on other legislation. What we are seeing here, as we're saying in the presentation, is to say, let us rather, because it's so little money, so I can't go today and have a small-scale mining workshop go Mukopane, and then tomorrow my colleagues come to consult on the mining charter go Polokwane, then the next day there's an Izimbizo in Zinsishio, you know? So we're just saying that as we are rolling this out, and it must be, yeah, we're talking Limpopo things. We're talking Limpopo things with the Hoshi. No, so we're saying that it definitely, they are currently happening in all provinces, but we just want to get a bigger band, and we want to take that out and coalesce them, join them properly, bring those funds together so that we are clear that when we go there, we address more than one target. And it might mean that we have, as I say, a separate session with the Hoshi, and then a separate session in the general community, a separate session with an entrepreneurs thing, entrepreneurs organization. But it means that the funds and the efforts of the state must be focused, and when we take up to the people, we do it together, and we do it in a big band rally. And definitely it must be everywhere. We definitely would want to meet with to work with the youth structure of the traditional leaders that they are establishing. We would put them in contact with the other youth structures, particularly in mining. Again, the effort here is not to reinvent the wheel, but to learn from each other's best practice so that they start. These guys have been struggling with this thing for many years, and it's not necessary for another organization to do the same thing. They must learn from the KZN chapter, they must learn from the national chapter, and that we are very eager to do. Hoshi Mandela, these outcomes are not mine, and I do not mean to throw them there. What is the challenge is that it should have been clear that these are outcomes as linked to Vision 2030 of the NDP. So in everything that we are doing, NDP was adopted by this parliament and as a country document. And until there is another notice to the contrary, that is our Bible. And those outcomes are derived from the medium-term strategic framework of government, which is broken down into 5-year chunks towards 2030. 2014, 2019, honorable members, being the first MTSF period for implementation. And in there, these are all the government outcomes that we are intending to achieve. Decent employment through inclusive growth is the increased investment through job creation. Vibrant small and medium scale enterprises is also under outcome for decent employment through inclusive growth, rural development and improved spatial distribution of wealth in under outcome 7 of government. So what we'll definitely do is that when we come back, we will make it clear that this is outcome 4, sub-outcomes, these are the sub-outcomes that we're responding to or we are supporting, and this is what we target to achieve as well. I think that you make a very fair point, and I think that that's something that we'll do as a team. What we didn't want to do is to say we want 12 women entrepreneurs, 6 black entrepreneurs, and 3,000 jobs. We didn't want to do that before we finish this period of really gathering the evidence. Once we say that we have received 70 projects, we can say to ourselves, we can start setting targets for ourselves, because we're already asking them as well to say, how much is your investment? How many jobs do you intend to create through that? And we certainly will have to come back to you to say, we received 70 projects. This year, we're giving ourselves the task of facilitating 12 of these, creating this much in jobs and this much in investment generation. I think that we'll take that note back, Nkosi Mandela, that you don't want us to speak at that high level, but if you just give us at least until the end of the process, so that we give you numbers that are rooted in facts and in activities that are happening on the ground. I think Honorable Lorimer reminded us that we're a state, we're not business people. We can support business people, but we're not business people. So what we need to do needs to be about facilitating the businesses that are on the ground. So we won't give you targets that are not rooted in facts. But the fact that we can't come here and say women will be empowered, youth will be empowered, I think we'll make that very clear at home and to all who are working on the project, Khoshimandel. People with disability, definitely, I think that we need to reflect that. It can't be taken for granted. We were told again, and we're told a lot to say that the mining industry has got no right to shy away from issues of people with disabilities, especially at the rate at which people are injured and rendered disabled by the industry. So the industry needs to be going above and beyond at all times in terms of the treatment of people with disabilities. We will definitely make sure that that is reflected in the program when it comes to an end. The dollar signs, by the time that we have adopted this model and it's been approved, we will have a proud bar or Randella sign on it. But it was just because that was a model that we had borrowed and we wanted to show you that this is what they're doing elsewhere and this is how we're thinking about tweaking it. But we're definitely, you see, in the mining industry as well, we take currency valuation with a double-edged sword. When it's devalued, we are more competitive in terms of our output, but our inputs tend to be a little bit more expensive. So we have got an ambivalent relationship, but we're normally okay when it's on the lower side and others are having to pay more for their imported cars. My thank you, Chair.
Okay. Any follow-up?
Thank you, Chair. The last 10 questions. The last 10. The last one, Chair, which is it will need the interventions of Mr. Zwindi, the DG, and the officials here. And in particular, us. Committee, because it will need a lot of resources. The issue I'm going to talk about, the issue of publications and widespread communications of your strategy and your toolkit. Will you consider, I don't think you will have to answer this question, Mr. Zondi and the officials, you will take it to the principals. relates to when we are going to publish this publication, we will consider, of course, the 11 official languages of South Africa. We will also consider the sign language. I'm told the sign language is more expensive because it will need all the processes, you need the braille and all this stuff. So when you publish this thing, consider it, because the number of people who are deaf, some of them are engineers, are more learned than some of us who are here. You will have to consider them, because I saw them in various provinces. I don't want to mention the name of that particular province, but all the provinces in the country. Yeah, whatever. So you have to consider them, because I'm a workaholic. I've met a number of structures of such people. And in particular, in my area, there's a school for them.
Yeah,
Madiba knows about the school.
Yeah.
From that side. So consider them, because so that when I take the report back to them, I'll be able to say, yes, indeed, your issues are going to be addressed by your Department of Mineral Resources.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Zondi. You don't have to answer it, Mr. Zondi. It is upon your principles. But next time, I think you'll be able to tell me when you come and report this, how far are you with regard to the programs you are presenting to us today. Thank you very much.
So
Mr. Zondi, you are asking this question not for the benefit of the committee. He must report to you. No.
I get it.
Is it because there is a new DG? We are changing the reporting line. Zondi, you are reporting to my client. I find it very strange that someone was so enthusiastic about using an example about one province, and then in his submission is making multiple examples and direct interest about his own province. He's fighting just the mentioning of one province. And then he goes even beyond his province to his own village. it's quite an interesting. Honorable members, I think the point you're obvious is taken. I don't think it's a question that it must only be. For me, I would have expanded more. Honorable Matala, to say, in terms of the model, is it really user friendly? And I think that's the question you have to go and ask yourself. Honorable Matala talk about sign language. It's not the only thing. The entire language system, to me, it has to be considered. And I couldn't guess. It's not a criticism. Maybe it's because when we are sitting here, there's one common language that can put us together. But in terms of the entry level, I think it's important to look at a user-friendly system, especially when it comes to language. I know it's a very costly, it's not a joke, it's not a very costly exercise, but it's something that it has to consider. Is there any other matter, honorable members? In the absence of that, I think one thing that probably we might request from you on the interactions that you have had, because I think this is not a matter that you can just get a presentation from the department and then sit comfortably without talking to those people, whether are they satisfied in the manner in which you are. You are performing your work of trying to assist. So I think if you can help at least of your stakeholders in the junior mining forum. I saw you talked about interactions from March and so forth. If we can get it so that we can have a way, I'm not saying we'll run with all of them, but we can have a way of bringing them also so that they can share with the committee what could be their own assessment, and if there are any suspicions that they have, what could. We're sitting here, we're not junior miners, except if there are a few that I don't know. So, like you said, nothing for us without us. We may be asking this committee that now is just listening to the department and then it asks questions for itself, and then when it is satisfied, it says, oh. So we might at some point, if you can help us with the list, especially on how we interact with them. Because if you've got, for example, 15 of them, there's no way you can ask them to come here if you only shoot to speak all 15 of them. But maybe we can get two so that we speak on their behalf in the manner that you are interacting with them. It will assist us. We can't go out and reinforce. I know if you were to do that, then others will say, how did you, what criteria did you use? So we just have to get a sample. Not that we are questioning what you are saying, that is different, but it's the effectiveness. Maybe they may have different ideas on how they think you can do to assist them. So I think for the benefit of the committee, if you can forward us, I don't know when, but last time I checked, you had improved. Although sometimes it's very difficult to work with them. When it comes to information, Babuzon, we're not going to forget that one. Because you are here, when are we, probably we are closing. No, this thing is just to give us. These are the people that we have connected with them, they forwarded to us. So it can't take even a, I would have said if I was rough and say, next day, this is tomorrow. But can we have this information at least, what is the day today? Can we have this information by the can we get this information at least by the
calendar?
Can you have this information by the 13th? I know you can even provide it today. It's nice to see that parenting is a good thing. Now, I understand the young one, in order to sleep, there's a particular music that was created. You can feel it. Congratulations, Bate. Good parenting. Okay. In the abs, thank you very much. I'm sure we will run up. I don't think we will finalize it on this thing. Down the line, you still owe us, Babuzon. You know, I'm sure you've been here. I was just asking myself in the whole scheme of things, the work that you are doing as a department, how does your standard system help you? But still another outstanding work to go and have a physical feel of how that system works. Because to some degree, some of us at it from a distance, it sounds to be not user friendly itself. One, two, it may, I'm trying to battle the transformational nature that it can be used as a tool. But that's another matter. Okay, honorable members, we've done so. Before we go to the minute, there is a, I don't know, put them as they must get this so that it can help them. You can even give them a book.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I've consulted with my colleague, Ms. Mohale. We provided information I've consulted the to be able to provide it by this coming Friday, which is the 27th of May.
That's why you said we're giving you up until the 30th. If you bring it tomorrow, it's much better. Because sometimes I assume you forget. I've given, honourable members, with an operational plan that we have not been able to finalise, which goes up until 2019. Not with the powers vested in me, but with the way that I so appreciate working with you, I think it would be proper to give you a chance, a week, it will be proper to give you a chance. I want to make that concrete suggestion that we still have got the Gauteng, Limpopo, Mpumalanga oversight report that you need to finalize, which was not specified. We will try and circulate it probably by tomorrow or Friday. We have to put it. The latest it will be at least Monday. The Limpopo, Mpumalanga, Gauteng, which was mainly on illegal mining. So my concrete suggestion is that next week, instead of doing anything, we deal with that oversight report, and then we deal with the operational plan. Because this is what we'll be working on, we give you a week to look at it, and where possible, they come back, and then we'll have a discussion and proposals on what then will be on the operational plan. Is that in order? Not like in the, I won't say that, because I'm undermining another structure, lower structure, where it works on the basis of agreed, and then the next time they have a problem, they forget that they said agreed. Any move of that proposal?
Thank you very much.
Any second, Honorable Mapola?
I second the motion, thank you.
No, thank you. Okay, can we then go to the minutes? Minutes of the 10th of May. Honorable members, I will come to this matter later. Let me just pack it now. Any corrections on the minutes of the 10th on page 1? Page 2? Okay. Any move of the minute? Honorable Nyambi. Any second? Honorable Pigini. Okay. Honorable members, just one issue on the minute. It's either it's an oversight on our part, or it's either we will not have. In terms of your NA rules, I think it's rule 38. Okay? I'm using what is in front of me. with Ms. Mohal and boss, there might be something in common.
Yeah.
They take the stage, they don't need to be given. Rule 38, subsection 1, for starters. A member may not, without his, note that, without his or her party's approval, be absent from more than two consecutive meetings of a committee to which the member has been appointed as a full member in terms of the role. Now note it says without his or her party's approval. Subsection 2 says a member's approved absence from a meeting of a committee referred to in sub-rule 1 must be recorded in the minutes of the meeting as formally adopted by the committee. Now what becomes the problem here is the approver of his or her party is not stating how the approval arrives at the committee. That is the problem. Whether you get an approval and that's it. But the committee, how does it record something it doesn't have? Then, 3, the secretary to the committee must without delay send a copy of the formal minutes of each meeting of the committee to the responsible whip of each of the parties represented on the committee. Now the assumption here, I can assure you, is only the DA and the ANC that might have a whip. The rest of those people, if they are not absent, they represent themselves. So the assumption is that in each committee, each party which is represented, was it not saying to the chief whip or to the whip, it says to the whip in the committee. Now how do I send a letter to someone who is a representative that you are not present at the meeting? But that is the dilemma. Now, sanction, let me leave the one of the sanction. Four. That is sub-rule 4. The secretary must every 3 months within a session submit a report to the speaker on all members who have been absent from 3 or more consecutive meetings of the committee without approval as recorded in the committee's minutes. Now the problem there, it says 2 above, but below it says after every 3 months of a session, a member who has not been present without approval on 3 consecutive, now no longer 2. I'm bringing this thing because we might ourselves be, I don't want to say, have tacitly been unable to do a follow-up on this matter. And we have always had, I'm not sure, this old chapter does appear, but we have got a consistent member. And it's not a blame to him, just as an individual, even previously, starting from the first member they submitted. Honorable Mukwe, I don't know which is. Has there ever been in one this year?
No.
I don't remember seeing him in even one of the meetings this year. Now it's whether that's where we both must help us then before I ask the question. So that it's not a dereliction of duty. Because there seems to be a honor on the part of the committee to do something when the member is not present. That's what seems to be an expectation on that vote. We have always been getting this thing and then
expressing the truth. I know some honorable member will always say it must be noted. Boss, can you take us out now? That is your time to help us as a community before we allow members to take on the night. Yes. What do you think is supposed to be done?
Can I follow up, check this with you?
Okay. Honorable member, Honorable Schmidt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you are duty bound to follow the rules. So whatever the position is, the secretary must still report every member who has not been here for three consecutive meetings. But you will have to do so in respect of every member and not just a particular member. Because I haven't checked the records, but there may be another member who may also be involved. So if you do, you'd have to do it evenly with regards to all members and not with regards to a particular member, if you follow what I'm saying. So, but you are duty bound to do so and to do so evenly and fairly in respect of all members.
Okay. No, that's why I was saying, but rest assured, this one by record, I know. That's why I was saying the only person, but in the last meeting I know was present, is Honorable Jackson. See, Honorable Esteza is an alternate. That's how it's written, he's an alternate. He's not a member of the committee. He's an alternate. This one says who is directly appointed to serve in the committee. But the intention, I think, let's leave it to the secretary. I think it might be an ideal to just alert. I don't think the issue is about being punitive, but all the problem is that the committee will have to share the blame if it has not done anything about it. That's the point. I think we have taken that thing that let's give. I would suggest, if honourable members are here, that the secretary, although he's not saying here on the rules, but I think it is a justification, will have to give notice to the, because I think honourable members, for an example, if we were to make that as they might have been given an approval by his party not to be present. But his party may not have communicated, but I think that's what supposed should have communicated with the committee. And then the committee, it can't do anything. The committee, all what it needed is to make sure that his absence in the committee as approved by the party is recorded. That's all thing. It must be on record that he has got this approval and we do have it, and then the secretary, we may have to take it to the speaker's office. I agree with you 100%. In general terms, I think this will cut across members of parliament who are serving in committees. I think specifically in this committee, all what we need is that if I can write with the chief whip of the AFF, all what we are requesting is the letter of approval for the absence of Mr. Mkwena, Honorable Mkwena, and if they say so, then we request that please can they forward it to the committee for the attention of the committee, so that it can be in compliance with Rule 38, ne? Of your 9th edition of the rules of the National Assembly. And then on the basis of that, you can give them notice in terms of that Rule 38. When you give them notice, all what you are requesting for now is to give us that so that we can be in compliance with what is expected from the committee point of view. I don't think even it has to come yet. It will just have to be as recorded, taken straight, including with the party's approval to the speaker. Is that an honorable Schmidt?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm still not sure, and maybe that's something which Mr. Boss can find out. Is even in the event where someone does have approval to not attend two subsequent meetings, so I think that's what the rules said you just read out. So if the person may have the approval of his party not to attend two consecutive meetings, Then the first, next subrule says, in the instance where a member does not attend three consecutive meetings. So, just found out whether despite a member having approval not to attend two consecutive meetings, the fact that the secretary must still report to the speaker in the event where he does not attend three consecutive meetings. So it may be two different obligations or two different issues where even if he does have permission, he must still report in the instance of three non-consecutive meetings.
That's why I think that's the point. That's why I said what it seems is putting an obligation to the secretary to report. So she would must do that part. But the part that involves you, us, as a committee, is the one that says that approval must be recorded in the minutes of the court. That's where, as a committee, we come in. Beyond that, I think it's the task of this committee secretary to put that in operation. So I think she will do that. What we can only do is when the secretary comes back, she will then tell us, because if there is no approval or whatever from the party, there's nothing we can do. She will still have to do her job in relation to that. So we can't record here, we can't record something that is not reported. So it will not arise. The way I read it, it's only up to her, even if it's more than three or whatever. It's supposed, what you report is when there is something, it must be recorded. That approval must be recorded in the minutes. And we can't record anything now because there's nothing. Okay? On that, you are released. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Long live the chair.
Long live the chair.
I just wanted to give my phone number. I just changed the number, and you know, I didn't have my email address there. So I've just written that by hand, but it's just my first name, .mohale@gmr.gov.za.
I just remember not before now that I was in Wadang.
Oh, yeah.
I know very well.
Okay.
I work for you. I've retired from the
job. I don't know.
I know very well.
Okay. Okay.
Have you related to you?
No, I just assumed that all Mahale, but somehow I couldn't marry a Mahale, even if they are.
You never know.
You never know.
Yes, it's just